virtual patching, typically that's involved where you have a VMs running, where you can cycle out. When you're talking about control, supervisory, servers, you can sometimes have virtualization in play. But most of the time when you're talking about remote field equipment and remote field devices, usually virtualization hasn't got there yet. So yes, if you're in the luxury where the servers you're dealing with are running virtualized servers, then that's ideal because you can bring up another virtualized environment, patch it. If it doesn't work, just re-roll it back. So typically in your supervisory control area, you might have a little of that, but very, very rarely you're going to find that with field devices. So that's just not a luxury that we have today in a lot of those devices that these patches apply to. So when we go in and we determine the operational risk, that has to be done at an organizational level. The question is, when we talked about hardening the system before system acceptance testing and removing services that are not required, can we solely rely on the vendor to tell us that? Absolutely not. And the reason is they don't know your environment. Remember, the reason why there's extraneous services is let's just make the life of a vendor real simple. At the most simplest level, what is the goal of a vendor? To have happy customers. What creates a happy customer? When things work. How do you guarantee that things work? Have the superset of services that are needed by any one of your customers running on your unit, so when it gets plugged into any environment, your customers will be happy because you have the superset of services. So vendors are typically going to go in and give all possible services that any customer might require to increase the happiness and effectiveness of that customer, which means they don't know what you are or not running in your environment. They don't know what protocols you're using to communicate. They do not know how you're interconnecting everything together. So ultimately, you're going to have to understand your environment to determine what protocols are needed to be able to tell the vendor so you can work with them to remove services that are not needed. So you have to go to the vendor and say, in our environment, we are using X and Y to communicate, and then the vendor can tell you what services to turn off, but the vendor doesn't know your environment. The reason why there are extraneous services is because they're trying to encompass the superset of all environments. So you have to provide the data to the vendor so they can give you the accurate advice of what is or is not needed to be running. But you have to give them your environmental conditions so they can tell you that. Remember, I said both work together. You don't know the vendor's product, and the vendor doesn't know your environment. So you have to go in and share details of the environment. The vendor has to share details of their implementation, and then together you can decide what services are needed or not needed. But typically it's the company that needs to provide the requirements to the vendor first so the vendor can assess what's required within that environmental condition. But it is a coordination. Neither one alone can make that decision. So we've talked about the lifespan and the fact that a lot of this equipment can't change in place. I've also talked about the importance of hardening, testing, and validating during your factory and site acceptance testing. If the vendor is not involved in these two steps, you are doing a disservice to your organization because you need to get the knowledge base that that vendor has. That vendor can work with you during the testing to be able to tell you, wait. If you're deploying it in this specific setting, why don't you just turn those off? You don't need to worry about those right now. Let's turn off or harden those boxes. So yes, a definite theme of this week is you need to be very close between vendor and company to be able to work closely together, and they should be actively involved in the testing, minimalizing the install base. The less code you have when that system goes live, the easier, better, and more straightforward it is to secure it within your organization. And there are toolkits out there. For example, DHS has procurement language where you can actually put in the contractual language methods for putting the vendor to provide information on risk, being able to apply patch information within a 30 or 60 day interval and being able to go in and work with the vendor on what the security requirements that are needed within that environment. Remember though, contractual language is good. Going in and notifying the vendor what security requirements you're expecting them to handle are good, but you cannot transfer safety liability. That is one of the fundamental rules in almost all countries is I cannot go in and transfer safety liability to a vendor. If you are running a control system environment, you are responsible for safety, period. So be careful here. While yes, you want to put contractual language to make sure the vendor is working within your zone of control, ultimately you're responsible. You can't just transfer everything to the vendor and say it's the vendor's fault. You share responsibility, so you still have to be careful in terms of how you do your risk assessment. So now that we've talked about some of the complexities of the ecosystem of ICS and the different types of systems that are out there, we're then going to go in and look at some of the different field components that we're going to run across. But before we move to our next module, any questions on what we've just talked about and covered? So eventually, you're going to go in, and we are seeing some similarities. The question was, are we starting to see our ICS environment becoming more and more like our IT environments in terms of how they function and operate? Yes and no, and let me explain. Absolutely, we're seeing that movement. We are seeing a lot more Windows and a lot more Linux in ICS than we did 10 to 15 years ago. So we're seeing a lot more of those standard OSs. We're seeing a lot less proprietary protocols. We're seeing a lot more TCP/IP and a lot less serial proprietary protocols out there. So in the general big picture, we're absolutely seeing ICS systems becoming more and more similar to ICT systems. The reason why I said no is I don't think we're ever in the near future going to see ICS systems have a 3 to 5 year lifespan based on the ruggedness, the remote nature, and where those devices are. I still think you're going to see that difference where you're going to see the IT lifespan continue to decrease to 2 to 3 years, and you're going to see the ICS one maintain at that 15, 18 year mark, which means as close as they want to merge, if IT systems are replaced every 2 to 3, and ICS are every 15 to 18, you're still going to have that backlog. So for example, if we roll out brand new state-of-the-art ICS systems today, and we roll them out with Windows 7, the latest desktop operating system out there, fully supported, fully up to date, what's the problem? That ICS system that goes in the field today will be running Windows 7 for the next 18 years. Is Windows 7 going to be supported for 18 years? Uh-uh. Microsoft typically has about a 6 to 8 year lifespan. So I can almost guarantee in 12, 13, 14 years, while it still has 5 years left on its lifespan, it's now running an obsolete operating system. So that's going to always be the issue factor, is even if ICS and IT become identical, because one changes every 2 to 3 and one is 15 to 18, there's always going to be that backlog between them in terms of obsolete and out-to-date operating systems, protocols, and other components. Excellent. So if there's no other questions, let's go ahead and look at some of the field components that we're going to run across, some of the different devices, some of the different operating systems and safety instruments that we're going to run across on our system. As I've been hinting at all day, one of the most critical, fundamental components of control systems are PLCs. PLCs are your programmable logic controllers. From small environments to large environments, you're going to see PLCs come into play. They are specialized computers, typically microcode, that are typically going to be able to take inputs from multiple sensors and send output to multiple devices in order to manage and control the environment. So the coordination, remember when we talked about industrial control systems, are basically three things. They're sensors that provide information to supervisory control logic units that ultimately send commands to remote field devices to change or alter how they behave. The PLC is what controls that communication. The PLC is the component that pulls the information from the sensors, sends it to the supervisor control unit, and then pushes the information back out to the devices to make or control changes within your environment or organization. Heck, in my house, we actually, my wife regrets making this decision now, but when we had our house built 5 years ago, me and her made a rule. Neither one of us could say no to the other. Anything she wanted, she got. Anything I wanted, I got. And we couldn't veto each other, which sounded like a great idea because she got all the stuff she wanted in the house. What she didn't realize is I was going to go in and make our house a smart home. So our entire house is smart panels. We don't have light switches. We don't have any. It's all smart panels controlled by touch panels, iPads, and tablet-based systems. So based on that, where all of our electrical, HVAC, TVs, audio, everything is controlled, we actually have, I counted it when I started teaching this class earlier in the year, we have over 17 PLCs in my house. Now, they're much smaller programmable logic controllers, but we actually have them to control the voicemail, the lighting, the temperature, and all those different components in place. So we're seeing more and more that many of your houses probably have some sort of PLC to control and manage those environmental factors that you're going to run across. So even in small environments like houses, up until oil refineries and nuclear power plants, the PLC is really that glue that controls all of that communication. And they absolutely need to be real time. As I mentioned, they are the brains. And in many cases, these PLCs have to be able to operate in high stress situations, weather, environmental, temperature controls. We have PLCs with some of our clients that are running in temperatures of excess of 100 degrees. We have some PLCs that are running in temperatures of excess of 15 to 20 degrees below zero. Rain, weather, dust, dirt, these things have to be very, very robust and work very well. And what is the big area? It's hard to see here, but these connections are the real critical component of it. Because if those connections start getting dust, corrosion, water, or other factors, and those connections come loose or don't work, pretty much the effectiveness of the PLC goes down. So a lot of the focus is on the robustness of the interconnectivity of those devices. When we often go in and do testing when they're deploying new PLCs, one of the things we literally do before it goes into production is we grab that and yank it as hard as you can and make sure that thing still works, because I'll tell you, that's not going to be near as bad as what's going to happen to it over the next 15 to 18 years. So that's the kind of robustness we're talking about when we say high-stress situations. That thing needs to be able to work if it's clobbered with hail, snow. Heck, we've had some environments where it gets hit by trucks on a regular basis, depending on where it's located within the facility. So this stuff has to be really, really robust in how it works and how it operates. The key components of the PLC is the programming of these components. So we have many different approaches that you can use for programming. One of the most common ones is ladder logic. And the reason we call it ladder logic is it looks like a ladder, where you essentially have your sequential flows of commands, you have your decision points between the commands, and then you have your logic of, based on a factor, what decision is made for that specific device. And this is one that if I gave you a large blueprint of ladder logic, you could, within a short period of time, be able to start to understand and determine data flows. So because it's sort of a decision logic tree, where everything is sequentially flowed in steps, fairly easy to be able to understand and see the logic and do verifiable security against it to see how it works and how it's set up. Function block is where you go in and you create groupings of code, sort of like subroutines or functions, and you take those groupings of code and put them together in terms of working modules. The nice thing about the function block is because you have a working module. Once you verify that working block, you can reuse it in other areas, other systems. Structured text is often what vendors use to lay out their implementation details in terms of how the system is set up. Often hard to read and hard to necessarily understand because it's often in a proprietary set language. Your instruction list is very similar to machine code assembly language, basic low-level functionality. If you read it a lot, you can get accustomed to it, but it's not something that's naturally going to occur. You have to understand the semantics of the terminology that's used in place. And then, of course, you can do sequential function charts, where it's essentially a logic flow. It's sort of like your ladder logic turned upside down, and then you sort of have a hierarchy flow of information to see the decision support that's broken down on the system. But like I said, a lot of what we often run across is the ladder logic because it's fairly easy to understand and determine the flow of information. Then we get into our field components known as your RTU, your remote terminal units. This is the stuff that's going to be pretty much hard to reach in remote locations that has to withstand high-end weather conditions, cold, heat, and pretty much needs electricity, and that's about it. There's no other environmental controls that are going to be in place there. And the most important part with the RTUs is the communication. You typically need some wide area network communication because these devices can be significant distances away from the actual supervisor control unit that's processing the sensor information and doing the logic control within your environment. Now, this is one wherever you have terms that have been out for a while, you sometimes have different meanings. I've always been brought up and always customary to RTUs being remote terminal units, but because they typically require WAN connections that were traditionally modem or telephony based, you do have some folks that call them remote telemetry units. So we just want to let you know that that's one of those acronyms that can have slightly different meaning. The good news is, it doesn't matter which one you use, it doesn't change the meaning. Whether you call it a remote telemetry unit or a remote terminal unit, it's still the same thing. It's a system that's typically out in the field, geographically dispersed, with the goal of gathering information from a sensor perspective and or altering or modifying motors, switches, or flow information to ultimately achieve the desired output of that control system. Excellent question. So the question is, what is the similarities and differences between RTUs and PLCs? Now, if you go in at one level, as the gentleman pointed out, there are similarities. Both have an array of input and output connections, and both of them have logic for being able to move and correlate that information and flow. Traditionally, RTUs were usually simpler devices than PLCs, and they were typically more suitable for large geographic areas. However, as the cost of microprocessors are coming down and we're seeing more and more diverse interconnectivity between them, the differences between RTU and PLCs are becoming less and less every day. So they're becoming more and more similar. I can go into some of our clients in what they traditionally called a remote terminal unit, now has so much processing, so much interconnectivity, and so close to the processing that technically I would call that a PLC. But originally it started off as a remote terminal unit because of the simplicity nature of how it worked. But over time, the enhancements that were made, that is becoming more and more like PLCs. So our guess is over the next several years, those terms are almost going to collide because they are very, very similar. I could take you to some vendors in what they're calling an RTU, and I can take you to some vendors in what they call a PLC, and there's not a lot of differences between them. So the differences are becoming less and less, but traditionally, RTUs were for large disparate areas, simpler devices, PLCs were typically more localized and higher processing capability. But like I said, those differences are blurring all the time. Then we get into our DPRs. This is our digital protective relay. Essentially, the DPRs are meant to detect faults in a system. Because if these devices are far, far away, and there's a problem or an issue with the processing capability, we need to be able to make sure that we identify those faults very, very quickly. So traditionally, your DPRs, your digital protective relays, they're going to report to your remote terminal units if there's a fault, and then the RTU is going to report back to the supervisory control unit so they can then deploy a technician, contact the vendor, or take appropriate action if something is failing or not working correctly within that environment. So we have ways of going in to be able to detect and correct faults that might be occurring in those field units. And then DPRs are a specific example of intelligent end devices, which are essentially endpoint devices that can make decisions, analyze, correlate, and provide information back to the person in the control center to tell them if there's problems, issues, or areas. Prior to IEDs, you typically relied a lot more on the person to analyze remote field data and make decisions. Now that you can have these intelligent end devices like DPRs, now the end devices can make much more intelligent decisions and now just provide a data point back to the operator. The operator has to do less analysis because now they'll tell them about a fault. Prior to these, you had your system operator would have to correlate all of the information from the RTUs and they would have to determine if there's a fault. That could take several hours to do. Now the DPR instantly tells them. So we're seeing a lot more intelligence and logic being put into those RTUs, which based on the question is making them more and more like PLCs in terms of their operation and their capabilities. Then we get into our PMUs, which is our phaser measurement units, and these essentially measure the electrical waves and voltages that are occurring within our system. When we're dealing, especially in the energy utility electrical sector, it's critical that we're carefully monitoring voltage regulation and monitoring those capabilities to make sure that they're working within the approved state. That's what PMUs do. Those phaser measurement units are going to measure those electrical waves and voltages and do time synchronized analysis. So if we go in and we look at a large electrical power grid where we're crossing over multiple locations owned by different entities and utility companies, the PMU is what's going to go in and be able to measure all those voltages and currents, make sure that as we're going between power grids that we're properly maintaining the proper voltage control, that we don't over or underclock when we're transferring utility energy between those different segments. So the PMU is really that brains behind the transmission of those electrical signals to make sure that all of those different power grids are playing nicely together and properly transferring the information back and forth between the different segments in a large country. And like I said, I apologize that we have pictures of the U.S. here, but there's just a lot of data available. One of the reasons why we utilize U.S. a lot is in many other countries, the power, utility, electrical are actually run and controlled by the government. So you have a single entity that's taking care of that. In the United States, the utility, electrical, water, gas, nuclear is regulated by the government, but it's actually run by private companies. It's actually run by privately held or publicly traded companies. So therefore, it's a much better model because you have a lot of different people and entities that have to play together. In many other countries, when you go to Europe or even in the Far East area, you have a single entity. So you don't have as much coordination that's needed like in the United States where you have a large number of different grid providers that all have to work together to transfer electrical utilization information back and forth. That's why we tend to use a lot of that in our examples because it makes a much better case study based on the nature of how it's been rolled out. Then we have our data concentrators. They're going to be responsible for taking information from different vendors and correlating it together in order to analyze utilization and being able to perform proper transfer. So now if you have one vendor that's underutilizing and another vendor that's overutilizing, you can actually cross-correlate that information, and the data concentrator can cross-analyze all the information, what's happening across multiple power grids. Then when we get in to the actual specialized operating systems that are running on each of these RTUs, remote terminal units, we often use this catch-all phrase called RTOS, which is real-time operating systems, and it's pretty much a category for all of the other ICS components that are out there. Any other component that's doing real-time operation, we're going to put in this category of these RTOSs, or real-time operating systems. And typically, when we get into the term RTOS, we're talking about very, very hardware-specific environments in which they operate. So we have examples like QNX, VxWorks, and even Windows CE, if we take a look at these. So RTOS was developed by QNX. It's a microkernel. Actually, they've been acquired by Research in Motion, or BlackBerry, and this typically will run on MIPS, PowerPC, ARMs, or x86 systems. Now, when we start talking about micro versus monolithic kernels, we have to understand sort of the slight differences between them. Typical ways of implementation was monolithic. A monolithic kernel is a kernel where you have independent, separate pieces that perform each of the individual parts that are needed by the operating system. And in a monolithic kernel, it cannot be altered, modified, or changed during normal operation. The kernel, by the way, is the brains of the operating system. It's the first piece that loads when you start up the system, and the kernel is what interfaces directly with the hardware to make it available to use by the rest of the operating system. So in a monolithic kernel, you're going to have your kernel broken down into device drivers, virtual memory, file system, virtual file system, and each one of these are independent, verifiable, that cannot be modified, changed, or altered during the normal running of the system. Now, the nice thing about a monolithic kernel is it's very hard to infect it with kernel-level rootkits because you can't alter, modify, or change any of the pieces. So each component is fully verifiable. So traditionally in ICS, we like the fact that we can fully verify all aspects of the kernel and it couldn't be altered, changed, or modified during the normal running. The problem, however, is this is fairly high overhead. There's a lot of code that's running and therefore could lead to performance components and issues in terms of how it runs and operates. So what we're seeing now is, for performance reasons, we're seeing a microkernel where pretty much all of this is shrunk down to a much smaller piece of code, thus the word micro, and then it tends to run a lot quicker, a lot faster, and a lot more optimized. And where microkernels really come into play is when you're dealing with specialized hardware, because a regular kernel has to deal with a lot of different device drivers. It has to deal with a lot of different memory types, a lot of different file systems. Well, guess what? If I'm running on a specialized piece of hardware, I have limited device drivers, I have certain memory, and I only have certain file systems, so now I could have a much more minimalistic, smaller kernel that's only focused on the minimal functionality that's needed, nothing additional, nothing extra. Well, the problem you get into the microkernel is, once again, it only has the minimalistic code needed for functionality, which then can create security challenges in terms of the verification and validation of that code. Then RTOS, another remote operating system, is VxWorks, and that's developed by Wind River Systems. In this case, the memory is separated from the kernel, and you can actually go in and do detailed debugging and analytical capability in terms of what's happening. Then back to the gentleman's question of what convergence do we see occurring between IT and industrial control systems, here it is. We're starting to see a lot more of them now utilizing Windows-based systems. Now, Windows CE is actually not a stripped down version of Windows. It's actually a much smaller microkernel. Windows CE is actually a completely rewritten kernel of Windows to run in a smaller hardware for dedicated reasons. One of the mistakes that is often made is people think Windows CE is a derivative of Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows ME, which is total garbage. And it's actually not. It's actually a separated microkernel. So it's, I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's actually a separate piece of code written specifically for smaller, higher speed hardware-based devices and can run on a lot of architectures. Now, once again, Microsoft was not satisfied with the fact that Windows CE actually might be more secure than Windows 95, so they had to throw IE in there, right? So, we have to have a little fun with Internet Explorer, right? So, we have IE might be included, so you just gotta be careful that there could be extra components added into that system. Then, as we continue through this section, a lot of the drivers in control systems are sensors. So you often have a sensory network where you have a lot of spatially distributed, very, very simple devices that can go in and monitor temperature, humidity, sound, air pressure, all those different components in order to feed back what's happening, especially in closed loop systems where the system can adapt and adjust over time. You absolutely need to have sensors in place. How in the world is a HVAC or a thermostat going to work if there's not a sensor in the room to determine what the current temperature is? So these sensors tend to be pretty simple, but have to be in the areas that are needed in order to pull and gather and correlate the information that's needed in order to allow the supervisor control unit to make the appropriate decisions. Then remember our three components of control systems. You have sensors, you have decision support, and then you have the field devices that are going to be altered, modified, or changed. So based on the information from the sensor, you're going to have your control units go in and open or close valves, pumps, burners, or do other controls to be able to alter or modify the operation of that control system to be able to maintain a steady state or achieve the ultimate goal of what it's after. We then also get in to our types of communication, digital versus analog. Digital is where there's only two states, 0, 1, on, off. Analog is where you can have a continuous state of communication. Because of the nature of analog being a continuous state, it's actually a lot less, it's much more inefficient than digital. You can get a lot more information in a shorter area with digital because there's only two states, 0 or 1, than you can with analog. And we've seen this trend occur in a lot of areas. Anyone who's worked in communication for 30 or 40 years, what were the original telephony PBX systems? Analog based. What do we do in the late 70s, early 80s in order to optimize and improve efficiency? We went from analog PBXs to digital PBXs to increase the efficiency and the bandwidth utilization. So we're seeing similar type activity on the ICS where you have your traditional analog communication, and we're seeing more and more of that move to your digital. So if you look at some of your field signals, your digital is typically simple on and off, open, close. So we're seeing a lot of that being moved. Relay, switches, reporting are moving to digital because it's an efficient way to be able to control the opening, closing of the different valves. However, in temperature and pressure and flow, where we still want to get some of that fuzzy logic or degrees of control, we don't just want on or off, we want more degrees. Analog is more indicative of fuzzy logic than digital waveforms. Digital waveforms is on, off. Analog is I'm getting hot, I'm getting cold, I'm getting warm. So because of the degrees of separation, anything in which we're going to be pushing towards the human-like natural language communication, your temperatures and pressure flows are typically going to still be on the analog side of the house. Then one of the ones we've mentioned this morning that is indicative of almost all control systems because of the importance of safety is going to be your safety instrumented systems. This is one of the most critical components that's going to go in and be able to detect and remediate any unsafe conditions that occur. This is your ultimate fail safe that if it goes in and detects a leak or an alarm, something is under overpressure, leakage of hazardous material, anything like that, your safety information system is going to go in and control, minimize, or contain the damage or the problem. That's why if you've ever been on airplanes and you've ever gone in and have major turbulence where the plane will start dropping and sometimes it will automatically pull back up, that is a safety functionality in those airplanes. Yes, the pilot is flying that plane, but there are safety controls in place that if something dangerous tries to occur or the pilot could get harmed, there is a safety system that will override and try to stabilize that airplane. So those are all conditions that we see in a lot of different control systems from nuclear energy airplanes or anything where safety could be an issue. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at some of the field components, we've looked at a couple of the other terms, we've looked at PLCs in a little more detail, we're then going to go in and look at some of our network components and communication components that are in play. However, before we do that, any questions or comments on what we've covered so far, what we went over? Excellent. So in the spirit of no news is good news, let's go in and we'll start our journey. We probably won't finish before afternoon break, but I just want to start to introduce the topic because it's a little too early to take break now. We have about 12 minutes. So let's go in and talk about some of the network components, communication equipment, and we're going to start to briefly introduce the TCP/IP implementations. And then on day 4, when we talk about our network controls, we're going to reintroduce and look at our protocols in a lot more detail. So we're just going to introduce it here and then drill down into IP, ICMP, TCP, and UDP on Saturday when we get to that specific section. And I don't know about you, but nothing brings warmth to my heart and makes me happier than on a Saturday afternoon we get to talk about protocols. I mean, that's just awesome. Right, it doesn't get much better than, okay, I'm not selling you on that, okay? I'll have to work on that one. And Graham's in the back of the room just shaking his head going, don't even try, right? Not going to make it any better that we're here on the weekend, and I should probably stop reminding you of that fact. So let's go ahead and jump back in to our network communication devices, and we're going to jump into our communication gateways. These essentially are used to facilitate gathering of data, movement of data, and conversion of different protocols. It's not uncommon in industrial control systems that you're going to have vendors that are using proprietary protocols that don't work with each other. So you're going to have vendor A that's going to be using one protocol, vendor B using a different protocol, and they don't talk directly together. So we would have to use a communication gateway in order to convert the protocols back and forth so those different devices can communicate, update, or provide information. It's typically very common that depending on the industry you're in, that you can have a variety of field devices that for various reasons, the sensors or devices are made by different vendors and they are not always cross compatible. So for all those reasons, communication gateways become real critical for that setup. Traditional communication gateways typically utilized RS-232 or 485 jacks to communicate, but we're seeing a lot more now switch to USB and Ethernet as the communication mechanism. So back to your question of the convergence of IT and industrial control systems, we are seeing more of our local TCP/IP network and communication equipment in place, but here's the challenge that you always have. Typically, you're not going to go in and replace all your equipment at once. That's usually a dangerous high risk. You might go in and replace your communication gateways, but you're not going to necessarily replace some of your field equipment for a few more years. So if you now go in and you have some newer equipment that are Ethernet based and you have some equipment that is still RS-232, that means that your brand new communication gateways have to support both the older and the new. Otherwise, you won't be able to connect those devices together. So that's sort of the reason why a lot of this stuff is still out there for a longer period. Now, what happens? This communication gateway gets deployed, and then in 3 years, you get rid of the old equipment, and now you're running pure play TCP/IP or USB, but now all your devices still have the old communication equipment there. That's why when you go into a lot of these areas that are doing modernization efforts, a lot of the equipment still has the legacy ports in there, even though nothing is plugged into them, because of the delayed rollout, that when it was originally rolled out, there was still legacy equipment that got pulled out since the communication gateways were put in place. Then we have our FEPs, our front end processors. These go in and take care of all the communication actions informing the centralized system. They typically will integrate functions that were typically done in separate applications, like alarm dispatching, backup, diagnostics, data communication, and they'll be able to put that all together into a single unit to allow better communication between all those different devices. Now, one of the problems you get into place is when you get into any specific environment, you're going to have many different interfaces that vary from site to site. So here's the problem. If you now have all these different connections at all these different sites, and you had to have that designed directly into your front-end processors, if I was a vendor, I would now have to have 30 different front-end processors for every single type of interface that's out there. So what they decided to do is separate out the two. So now you have a communication module that's going to interface directly with the unique requirements of each site, and then that's going to plug in to your front-end processor. So now we, in essence, can create a generic front-end processor, and we only have to get unique communication modules for the specific equipment at your site. The communication modules will be unique for your site, and then that will plug into the generic front-end processor. So it's just a way to be able to make this a little more scalable, so you don't have to go in and have every piece of component specialized, just your interfaces are specialized, and then the other components are going to be fairly generic and scalable with your environment. Then, as I mentioned, a lot of people will argue that availability is important and is critical. But as I said, we can't forget about the integrity of the communication. If I'm going in and I'm using my control system to monitor a high-risk area and I'm getting false information, that could cause major, major problems. Let's go back to my previous example. If a pilot is in an airplane and there are components failing on that airplane and that information is not accurately portrayed to that pilot, if he knew about it, he could have declared an emergency and got the plane on the ground. But if that information was not properly presented to him, by the time he realizes it 15 minutes later, there could be a major failure and potential loss of life. So in terms of making sure that the information is accurate in terms of doing the monitoring is critical, because if you're getting false information, it could have a major, major impact on the overall safety of the systems that we're communicating with. Then we're going in and we're seeing more and more devices supporting Ethernet at layer 2 in the protocol stack for logical topology. We're seeing IP being used for routing and TCP and UDP being used for transmission of critical information within the application. Now, one of the terms you might have heard, and I often get a lot of questions on it from students, that's why we added this slide in, on this industrialized Ethernet or ruggedized Ethernet. All it's dealing with is the hardware components. So when we go in and we're talking about industrial or ruggedized Ethernet, it's the exact same CSMACD carrier sense multiple access with collision detection that we utilize on a regular network. It's just we now have ruggedized connections. It can handle extended temperatures and can just be a lot more robust in the functionality of the system. So when you see the term industrial or ruggedized before Ethernet, it's referring to the hardware not the actual logic of the devices and how they function and how they operate. And you can see a little bit in this picture. This is sort of a partially ruggedized, but notice the rubber surroundings that are listed there. Notice the reinforced screws for plugging in the connection components on that. Notice even the power supply has screws associated. Once again, the idea of industrial strength is you're not just plugging it in. You want to reinforce those connections so if they get hit with rain, snow, wind, or other conditions, they're going to stay working, functioning together. And as I alluded to earlier, when we talk about industrial strength, a lot of it is focused on the connectors and the connections because that's where things are going to fail. I can take a computer and I could put it in a sealed case. I can do proper ventilation of it. I can build a independent computer to work pretty well in rain, snow, heat, and other conditions. But it's the connectivity of wires that are ultimately going to go. Those connections are going to rot. Those connections are going to get water. Those connections, when you freeze, are going to expand to potentially break connection points. So we typically do a lot less plastic, more metal, more reinforced screws, as opposed to just putting in a traditional connection point in order for that to work correctly. The pros of utilizing Ethernet and TCP/IP and traditional OSI protocol stacks is much more standardized interoperability. You can work with a lot more equipment. The negativity is some of this is not meant to be as real time. Remember, when we're going in with Ethernet, it is carrier sets multiple access, which means you're sharing bandwidth. You're waiting for somebody else to finish in order for you to communicate. So if you have very chatty workstations that are utilizing up that bandwidth, there could be delays in terms of getting the update. There's not dedicated bandwidth or communication cycles, which could impact the real-time nature of what we're trying to accomplish here. And also, when you start adding in all these protocols, they are more complex than a simplified proprietary protocol, which means you might be running extra overhead for services that are not needed. And when you're talking about lower end hardware requirements, that could have a performance impact in your environment. Then we have our OLE for process control, known as OPC. This is your object linking and embedding for process controllers. The idea behind it is to be able to gather information from many different devices and have an industry standard for starting to correlate and analyze that information together. So notice that we are starting to see standardization across different vendors' products, so they're all speaking a common language. So now we can more easily be able to get information from different vendors, cross-correlate, and analyze that information to be able to make more robust, quicker, better business decisions within our organization. Then we get into Modbus, which is another open standard. Notice we're seeing a lot more openness, a lot less proprietary, a lot more cross-correlation and cooperation across vendors. It's a serial protocol in which it's master-slave. The master's going to poll each slave. Slaves do not communicate with other slaves. Slaves do not talk unless the master asks for it. So essentially, they're going to go in, all the devices, the field devices are going to be your slaves, and then your supervisory control units are going to be the master, and they can go in and poll each of the slaves to pull and gather the information. There is a limitation of up to 247 devices per network with Modbus. So depending on the size environment that you're working with, that's also going to impact the implementation. And then you have Profibus, which originally developed by Siemens, and there's lots of different versions of this. So notice what's happening here. We build an open industry standard, and then vendors make their own modifications and changes to it. So we sort of take an open standard, and then the vendors sort of proprietize it by going in and adding their own special implementation features. At least there's still some interoperability, but there's also going to be some compatibility issues now if vendors start to alter or make changes to each of those different areas. So it's 3 o'clock. So let's go ahead and take our afternoon break. We'll come back at 3:15. We'll finish up the device section will then make sure everyone's up and running on their system and make sure that you have your Samurai working, and then we'll walk through the first lab together. If for some reason you get back from the lab, from the break early, and you want to start getting a jump start, if you go to your DVD or your USB that you copied over, on it, you're going to notice that there is student notes. If you open this up, this is the installation instructions for your system. Essentially, you're going to install VMware Player. You're then going to go in and copy over the Samurai. You're going to unzip the Samurai on your system. You're then going to go to VMware, open up the Samurai distro, and you're going to start that up within VMware Player. And if you need to log in, it should auto log in, but if it doesn't, the login and password are both Samurai. And then when your system appears in this state, you know that everything's up and running and working correctly on that. So if you get back a few minutes early, that's great. Otherwise, we'll give you a little time in class at around 3:34 to work on that. But I figured some of you got back and was just sitting around, so you might as well get started on that. Tim and Graham will be walking around to help you set up your system. So if you're not familiar with VMware Player or you're not sure how to copy over anything, just wave your hand. We'll be walking around to help you. So with that, 3 o'clock, take a break. Come back in 15 minutes at 3:15. We'll then do a little more lecture, and then we'll jump in, get your system set up, and work on a quick lab together, and then finish up the lecture for today. So 15-minute break, and then we'll start back up again.